Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The model of aid distribution proposed by Israel does not align with core humanitarian principle. It will deprive large part of Gaza, the highly vulnerable people, of desperately needed assistance.
Israeli troops have fatally shot at least 10 Palestinians as they attempted to collect food and aid amidst the chaotic unveiling of a new Israeli-U.S.-backed aid distribution plan run by a shadowy U.S. group that sidelines the United Nations. We'll speak to Jeremy Scahill of Drop Site News about this and proposals for a new ceasefire in Gaza. Plus, we'll look at Israel's use of Palestinians as human shields in Gaza and the West Bank. We'll talk to Nadav Wyman, a former Israeli soldier who heads the group Breaking the Silence.
We got testifiers from December 2023 telling us that they were ordered to use Palestinians as human shields. And then we got more and more testifiers, different units, different times of the war in Gaza, and different places on the Gaza Strip, which means that it's a widely spread protocol in the IDF, and it's called the Mosquito Protocol, using Palestinians as human shields.
But first, the Trump administration's escalating its attacks on international students, with Secretary of State Marco Rubio announcing the U.S. will begin aggressively revoking the visas of Chinese students. We'll speak to Jamil Jaffer, head of the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Gaza, at least two people were crushed to death and two others fatally shot Wednesday as thousands of starving Palestinians rushed a United Nations humanitarian aid distribution warehouse in Deir al-Balah, tearing open its metal walls in a desperate attempt to find food. Witnesses described a chaotic scene as starving people clamored for the supplies.
I'm hungry and I want to eat. There's no flour, no food, no bread. There's nothing at home. Every time I go get aid, I take hold of a box and 100 people crowd over me. 300. I couldn't take anything. I just go home empty-handed. Before, the UN agency used to send me a message and I would go like any respected person. I'd take the aid and I'd go back home. Now there is nothing. If you're strong, you get aid. If you're not strong, you don't.
Gaza officials say at least 10 Palestinians seeking aid have been killed by Israeli forces in the past 3 days. The World Food Program said in a statement, quote, humanitarian needs have spiraled out of control after 80 days of complete blockade of all food assistance and other aid into Gaza. Gaza needs an immediate scale up of food assistance. This is the only way to reassure people they will not starve, unquote. Elsewhere, Israeli attacks so far today have killed at least 55 people across Gaza. Among the dead, Palestinian journalist Maltaz Rajab, who was killed along with four other civilians in an Israeli strike on his vehicle in Gaza City. He's at least the 221st media worker killed by Israel in Gaza since October 2023. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said his forces had killed Hamas commander Mohammed Sinwar. He was apparently the target of a May 13th strike in Khan Yunis, when Israeli warplanes simultaneously dropped six large bombs on the European hospital. 28 people were killed, dozens more wounded in that attack. International doctors and healthcare workers report they're increasingly being blocked by Israel from entering Gaza, with specialists approved for exits but denied new entry visas and what advocates are calling an undeclared medical siege. On Wednesday, U.S. trauma surgeon Dr. Feroz Sidwa testified to the U.N. Security Council about his time spent as an emergency doctor at the European hospital in Gaza, where he treated young children severely injured by explosives.
Children are supposed to be protected. In Gaza, these protections are simply gone. Every day, the distinction between combatant and civilian is erased. Most of my patients were preteen children, their bodies shattered by explosives, and torn by flying metal. The medical system has not failed. It has been systematically dismantled through a sustained military campaign that has willfully violated international humanitarian law. Civilians are now dying not just from the constant airstrikes, but from acute malnutrition, sepsis, exposure, and despair.
In the occupied West Bank, family members say Israeli soldiers burst into their home without warning early Wednesday before shooting 20-year-old Palestinian Jassim Al-Sadha as he slept. The young man was reportedly left to bleed to death with no one allowed to approach him. His killing came as the Israeli military continues its campaign of stepped-up raids and home demolitions across the West Bank, where Israeli ministers have just approved 22 new settlements, which are illegal under international law. It's the largest such expansion in Israel's history. This comes amidst a surge of attacks by settlers on Palestinian communities. On Tuesday, residents of Kariot reported Israeli settlers descended on their village without warning, setting fire to homes and property.
We were at home, sitting safely. There was no one outside at all. When we were surprised by the sounds of bangs and saw fire and smoke, we opened the door and were surprised to see a huge number of settlers and no one else. They set fires to cars and houses and damaged the neighborhood. They burnt maybe 10 cars, as you can see. They burnt the house and damaged the cars. They even hit people. I went outside and I was also beaten by a bat.
Meanwhile, a new Israeli law allows for children as young as 12 years old to be sentenced to life in prison. UN experts say the law is designed to punish Palestinian families and likely violates international laws, including the Convention of the Rights of the Child. In New York, a three-judge panel at the Court of International Trade has ruled President Trump's sweeping global tariffs were imposed illegally, blocking Trump for now from pursuing much of his trade war. The court agreed with business owners in a dozen states that sued Trump, arguing the president exceeded his authority by invoking a national emergency to bypass Congress in order to impose the tariffs. The ruling applies to Trump's so-called Liberation Day tariffs, which roiled global markets in April, and to his levies on Canada and Mexico that he claimed were related to the flow of drugs and people across borders. Industry-specific tariffs imposed on automobiles, steel, and aluminum are not affected by the order. The White House is expected to appeal. Stephen Miller, Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy, wrote on social media, quote, "The judicial coup is out of control," unquote. President Trump has nominated Emil Bovey, his former personal defense attorney, as and current Justice Department official, to the third U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Among other things, Emil Bovey threatened to fire attorneys in the Justice Department's public integrity section if they refused to file a motion to dismiss the corruption case against New York Mayor Eric Adams. And he accused FBI leaders of insubordination after they refused to identify agents involved in the January 6th Capitol insurrection investigations. Trump also announced new nominees for a federal district court in Florida. The Alliance for Justice this week urged senators to oppose Trump's previously announced judicial nominees, warning they all, quote, demonstrated their opposition to the protections of the law and their loyalty to the Trumpian agenda, unquote. Secretary of State Marco Rubio warned the government will start aggressively revoking the visas of Chinese students one day after the Trump administration announced it's halting the processing of visas of international students. Rubio said people with links to the Chinese Communist Party, China's sole and ruling party, would be especially targeted, as well as people studying in quote-unquote critical fields. Chinese nationals represent the second largest proportion of overseas students in the U.S. after India. Meanwhile, President Trump told reporters Wednesday Harvard should cap its acceptance of international students at around 15%. Last week, Trump revoked Harvard certification for admitting students from overseas. A federal judge in New Jersey has ruled the Trump administration's efforts to deport Columbia graduate Palestinian activist Mahmoud Khalil is likely unconstitutional. And arguments that Khalil represents a threat to national security and foreign policy are not likely to hold up. But Judge Michael Farbiars stopped short of ordering Khalil's release from a Gina, Louisiana immigration jail, pending developments on separate Trump administration charges against him related to his permanent residency application. Last week, Mahmoud Khalil testified that deportation would be life-threatening due to smears and lies by the Trump administration. He's married to a U.S. citizen who gave birth to the couple's first child, Dean, last month. Here in New York, masked federal agents arrested multiple people who showed up for appointments at immigration courts in downtown Manhattan Wednesday, including a family with small children. Police officers arrested protesters and observers who showed up to offer support and assistance, including a pastor. Community members also blocked vans carrying immigrants from driving down the street before police officers pepper sprayed, violently tackled, dragged them away. The Trump administration's reportedly ordered ICE to make 3,000 arrests per day. NBC News is reporting immigration judges have moved to dismiss at least 14 cases involving immigrants who were expelled without due process to an El Salvador mega prison under the Alien Enemies Act, despite ongoing legal challenges over Trump's invocation of the 1798 wartime law. One of the recently dismissed asylum cases involves Andre Hernandez Romero, a gay makeup artist from Venezuela who was apparently expelled because he had tattoos. In more immigration news, a federal judge in New York heard arguments Wednesday that could undermine the fate of some 500,000 Haitian recipients of temporary protected status, TPS, whose deportation protections are at risk of expiring in August after the Trump administration moved to prematurely cut off their TPS status. This is Aline Gay, executive director of Haitian Women for Haitian Refugees.
This is a huge disruption, not only to their lives, creating anxiety and harm, wreaking havoc in our communities at large, but it's also unlawful because this is precisely the reason why temporary protective status was created, right? For folks to not be returned back to situations that have a lot of political instability, violence, natural disasters, and that is exactly what we're seeing in Haiti today.
The White House confirmed Elon Musk will be leaving the Trump administration after leading efforts to gut government agencies while firing tens of thousands of workers through his Department of Government Efficiency. The confirmed departure came after Musk said he was disappointed President Trump is pursuing the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, a massive spending bill that increases the budget deficit. Musk said, quote, "I think a bill can be big or it can be beautiful, but I don't think it can be both," unquote. The Congressional Budget Office projects the legislation would add $3.8 trillion to the national debt over 10 years, slashing taxes for the wealthy while gutting social programs, including massive cuts to Medicare and Medicaid. Meanwhile, legal experts are sounding the alarm over a little-notice provision of the more than 1,000-page spending bill, which shields the president from contempt of court citations by federal judges. That would pave the way for the Trump administration officials to continue ignoring court orders without fear of consequence. Harvard's agreed to hand over 175-year-old photographs of an enslaved man and his daughter to a Black History Museum in South Carolina as part of a settlement with the descendant of the photo's subjects. The deal caps a 15-year legal battle between Harvard and Tamara Lanier, whose great-great-great-grandfather, Renty, is featured in the photos. Lanier celebrated the long-anticipated resolution, saying, quote, "This pilfered property, images taken without dignity or consent and used to promote a racist psychoscience, will now be repatriated to a home where their stories can be told and their humanity can be restored," unquote. To see more on that story, go to democracynow.org. And Namibia has issued fresh calls for reparations from Germany as Namibia marked its first National Genocide Remembrance Day Wednesday. Between 1904 and 8, German colonial invaders killed up to 100,000 indigenous people, most from the Ovejero and Nama communities. This is Ovejero leader Jose Ruaco.
What has happened here, because this is the first genocide of the 20th century, this was actually the prelude to the, you know, to the Holocaust. But this is not recorded anywhere. People are not aware of what has happened here to the same level and same extent as some of the other atrocities.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. Secretary of State Marco Rubio warned the government will start aggressively revoking the visas of Chinese students. One day after the Trump administration announced it's halting the processing of visas for foreign students as it prepares to require additional social media vetting for every applicant. Rubio said students with links to the Chinese Communist Party, which is China's sole and ruling party, would be especially targeted, as well as people studying in, quote, critical fields. Chinese nationals represent the second largest proportion of overseas students in the U.S. Meanwhile, President Trump told reporters Wednesday Harvard should cap its acceptance of international students at around 15%. Last week, Trump revoked Harvard's certification for admitting overseas students. Currently, over a quarter of Harvard's student body is international. Many of those students are now seeking to transfer to another school. Harvard's commencement ceremonies are taking place today. This week, Harvard students protested in support of international students. This is Pakistani international student Abdullah Shahid Sal, who is also the student body co-president of Harvard's Undergraduate Association.
I haven't had the time yet to think about my backup plans, but as of now, I don't think anyone is sure if they can return for their fall semester back into Harvard and more broadly back into the U.S. In that case, I would have to look for other options. I haven't looked at the list yet for the next available ones because the most transfer windows for most colleges have already been closed. But I also want to make it very, very clear that deporting international students doesn't solve any of this. We don't have any provided mechanism by President Trump's administration that deporting internationals in this particular manner will solve any of these issues.
This comes as a federal judge in New Jersey found the Trump administration's efforts to deport Columbia graduate Palestinian activist Mahmoud Khalil is likely unconstitutional, but stopped short of ordering his release from Jena, Louisiana immigration jail. In another high-profile case targeting international students and academics, a judge has granted bail to Russian Harvard scientist Ksenia Petrova, ruling her 3-month-long detention by immigration authorities is unjustified. For more, we're joined by Jamil Jaffer, director of the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University, part of a team of lawyers representing professors in their lawsuit against the Trump administration's repression of students and faculty involved in pro-Palestine activism. He was previously the ACLU's deputy legal director. Jamil, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. This attack on students at Columbia, at Harvard, around the country, and now the latest news that broke in the last hours about going after, in particular, Chinese students, the second largest number of students in the United States, well over a quarter of a million students. Can you just respond to what's happening here?
Well, I mean, I really don't think any foreign enemy could do nearly as much damage to the United States as the Trump administration is doing to it right now. I mean, even this policy alone, the one focused on Chinese students, is going to have an immediate effect, not just on the Chinese students who are already here, but on the willingness of Chinese nationals to come to the United States. That's obviously the whole point of it. But, you know, Chinese nationals who study in the United States bring a lot to the United States. I mean, it's a wonderful, amazing thing that people come from all over the world to study at American universities. You know, they enrich the experiences of American students at those universities. They pay tuition. They contribute to research collaborations. They engage in all sorts of socially useful projects that have implications not just for students and faculty at the universities, but for American society. It's an amazing thing. And the Trump administration is taking aim at, you know, at all of that. And it's going to have immediate and, I'm afraid, irreparable consequences for American leadership and prosperity. It's really just difficult for me to think of any conceivable theory on which this is going to help the United States.
And if you could respond also to the fact that the Trump administration has announced a pause in the processing of visas for all foreign students, and that it's done so at this time when the maximum number of students from abroad are applying for visas for September admissions. And just to make clear, there are over a million international students from over 200 countries enrolled in U.S. colleges. Yeah. That was the case, the numbers for 2023-2024.
Yeah, I mean, let me just start by saying this is so incredibly cruel to the, you know, for the people who are here. This is so disruptive, right? They have relied on the fact that they were given visas by the State Department. They are here lawfully. They are studying here at the invitation of the United States, and this is designed to, you know, disrupt their lives in the most fundamental way. But then beyond that, it's going to be such a big deal for these universities because foreign students make up a very high percentage of the students at major American universities. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but I believe it's something close to 40% at Columbia and somewhere around 25% at Harvard. And foreign students pay a disproportionate share of the tuition. So universities in the United States are reliant on the income they get from the foreign students who study here. And it's going to be a huge deal for American universities when all of these students who are studying here lawfully find it necessary to consider withdrawing, and all of the students who would otherwise apply to the United States end up applying to, you know, Canada or Australia or Europe instead.
Well, I'd like to go to comments made by Secretary of State Marco Rubio during a Senate hearing, the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, earlier this month. He said the Trump administration would continue to reconsider granting international student visas.
If you tell me that you're coming to the United States to lead campus crusades, to take over libraries and burn down, try to burn down buildings and acts of violence, we're not going to give you a visa.
Is that what Ms. Haas?
So, Jamil, that was Secretary of State Marco Rubio. If you could speak specifically about the Trump administration's justification for this. In other words, they're looking to expand social media vetting for every applicant. And also the fact that in his last administration, Trump already imposed a stricter review of visa applicants, including social media screening. So, yeah. First of all, why wasn't that reversed during the Biden administration? Is it difficult to do so?
Yeah, good question.
What kind of social media screenings are we looking at?
So this screening has been in place now for, a pilot version of it was put in place under the Obama administration. It's been expanded since then, principally by the Trump administration. It applies now to about 14 million people who apply for visas every year are required to submit their social media handles to the State Department with their visa application. And now the Trump administration is proposing to expand it even further. The evidence we have is that this program has been entirely ineffective at achieving the ends that the Trump administration says it was designed to achieve. The goal was to identify national security threats. There is no evidence at all that this program has resulted in the identification of national security threats. And in fact, my organization, the Knight Institute, sued several years ago under the Freedom of Information Act to find out how this program was actually operating and what the results of the program had been. And one of the documents we got in response to our FOIA request was a document from inside the Director of National Intelligence, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, conceding that the program had been ineffective. That was their word, ineffective. And now this program is going to be expanded. Now, it is ineffective at identifying national security threats, but it is very effective at chilling free speech and association that is protected by the First Amendment. And there is an ongoing lawsuit. We're involved in a lawsuit on behalf of two documentary film organizations, Doc Society and the International Documentary Association. We sued over the constitutionality of this program several years ago. The case is now pending before the D.C. Circuit.
And what about, why wasn't, sorry, just one second, the Biden administration, why wasn't this reversed during all those years?
So we repeatedly asked the Biden administration to reverse this policy. The Brennan Center, which we are working with on this specific issue, repeatedly asked the Biden administration to reverse this policy, and the Biden administration did not do that.
So you're a graduate of Harvard Law School. Actually, you were an international student from Canada at the time, right?
That's right.
You are work at Columbia University. Mm-hmm. By the way, the latest news out of Harvard is they're not only going to go after the students, but anyone they will be reviewing the visa who is involved there. But we just heard Marco Rubio talking about troublemakers, essentially, going after them and cleaning. Now it's a new rule, whether you live in another country or here and you're leaving the country, you got to pack your bags, clean your room, and clean all your social media sites, right, to help get back into this country. I want to ask about Mahmoud Akhlil. He's a Columbia student, now a graduate. Mm-hmm. He's imprisoned. He graduated while he was imprisoned in Louisiana. Negotiator between the students and Columbia University around the encampments. And then you have a judge ruling, a New Jersey federal judge ruling that it is likely unconstitutional what has happened to him. And you have a Vermont federal judge calling for the release on bail of a student Harvard scientist named Ksenia Petrova, who came into the United States and was taken by ICE and is jailed. Can you respond to these cases and the message they are sending and what has to happen here?
Yeah, I mean, let me start with the Khalil case. So this was an important legal victory that Khalil won yesterday before Judge Farbiarsh in New Jersey. And Khalil is very well represented. He has great lawyers at the ACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights. And I think that that legal victory is something to celebrate. But at the end of the day, he is still behind bars. You know, it's been almost 3 months, and he is still behind bars. And on the basis of what? Activity that is plainly protected by the First Amendment. You know, he's behind bars because of his human rights advocacy. And I think that, you know, that is a really incredible and shocking thing. If the First Amendment was supposed to prevent anything, it was supposed to prevent the government arresting you on the basis of your political beliefs. But that's what's going on here. And he has been detained for 3 months already. I think it's kind of, you know, crazy that it's already gone on for so long. And I hope that Judge Farbiarsh gets to the First Amendment questions very quickly.
And also, just to be clear, he's not a foreign student. He is a green card holder,
That's
lawful
right.
permanent resident of the United States. And then to ask about the Russian scientist who's at Harvard University, who was, she's also been detained in this Louisiana ICE detention facility for months. Now, in her case, she's also been criminally charged in addition to violating immigration laws. She didn't declare these lab frogs, I mean, that she had brought in from France, which is normally considered a trivial violation. Mm-hmm. She's been criminally charged for smuggling, for bringing in these frogs. But the Trump administration has also issued a detainer on immigration charges, which effectively means that even as if she's granted bail, with the judge yesterday ordered, if she's granted bail on the criminal case, the government could still get ICE to detain her. If you could elaborate.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very unusual reaction on the part of the government to what, as you say, is usually considered a trivial offense. I think the message here is, I mean, just, you know, beyond the kind of arbitrariness of it and the cruelty of it, the message here is not just to, you know, her specifically, but to any foreign national who's considering coming to the United States right now. Like, the message is, you're not welcome. And, you know, you see that message delivered through all of these policies, the one that we started with, the policy relating to Chinese nationals, the roundup of students who protested on campus last year, the revocation of Harvard's authority to host foreign students. Like, all of this is meant to send a broader message, which is that you know, foreign nationals aren't welcome in the United States. And, you know, that is deeply problematic for many of those foreign nationals, but it is also extremely damaging to the United States at every level, you know, from security to the economy to American prestige in the world, to our ability to carry out scientific projects that have very real implications for ordinary Americans. You know, it's not just people at Harvard who get cancer or, you know, get Alzheimer's. It's ordinary Americans get these diseases, and they need cures to these diseases. And the research is being done at major American universities, and it'll be much harder to do that research without foreign faculty and foreign students.
And the role of the courts, we just heard about the Vermont judge, yeah, the New Jersey judge. Overall, your assessment of them and the Trump administration, how it's responding first term versus this term. You have Stephen Miller, you just heard, saying this is a judicial coup when they are ruled against.
Yeah. I think that, you know, many of the district court judges are doing exactly what the Constitution demands they do. You know, the district court judges are ruling against the Trump administration in many of these contexts. We'll have to see what the Supreme Court does. You know, so the Supreme Court so far has been extremely cautious. You know, one theory is that they're worried about the Trump administration not complying with their court orders, and they're worried about the loss of institutional credibility that would come if the Trump administration ignored their court orders. But that's itself a kind of terrifying thing, that we're, you know, at the point where the Supreme Court is worried about whether the executive branch will even honor the Constitution in that way.
And if we could ask you about the case that you yourself, you're representing, the Knight Institute is representing the American Association of University Professors and the Middle East Studies Association, challenging the Trump administration's large-scale arrests, detentions, and deportations of foreign students and faculty who've been involved in pro-Palestine protests. If you could talk about that case.
Yeah, so this is a challenge to the policy of arresting, detaining, and threatening to deport students who participated in pro-Palestinian protests last year. You know, as we've already discussed, there are cases in which individual students who have been targeted have challenged their arrest and detention and threatened deportation. The Mahmoud Khalil case is one of those cases. But this case is a challenge to the deeper policy, and it's brought on behalf of faculty at universities across the country. And what they are pointing out is that these detentions have obvious implications for the students who are detained, but they also have this very profound chilling effect on all of the foreign students and foreign faculty who are worried about the possibility of being targeted. And this policy has really transformed life at universities around the country, really put a kind of blanket of fear and repression over these, you know, over campuses all over the United States.
And just 30 seconds on, this is often being framed as what these international students lose when they can't come to the United States. But the issue of what the United States loses, I mean, it's called a brain drain. Other countries are now calling this a brain gain that they'll get the students. But the shutting down of scientific labs, the lab, the research around Alzheimer's, around cancer.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's obvious what's going to happen. The most talented students and faculty from abroad, who until, you know, very recently have come to the United States, will instead go to Europe, or they'll go to Australia, or they'll go to Canada, and all of those countries,
or China, or Russia,
or China, and they'll, you know, all of those countries are seeing this as a huge opportunity, as I suppose they should. But it's very sad for the United States, because the United States, since the Second World War, has really led in higher education. You know, these universities, Harvard, Columbia, Stanford, these are the envy of the world, you know. And, you know, like I said earlier, I just cannot imagine the theory, any theory under which these policies are good for the United States at any level.
Jamil Jaffer, director of the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University. Coming up, we look at Israel's use of Palestinians as human shields in Gaza and the West Bank. We'll talk to Nadav Weiman, a former Israeli soldier who heads the group Breaking the Silence, back in 20 seconds.
silenciada. Soy el dolor que no siente. Soy la memoria olvidada. Soy material resistente. Con rabia despellejada.
Contra todo, Against Everything by Ileana Cabra Hoblar, better known as Ile, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to Gaza, where more evidence is coming to light about how Israel has systematically used Palestinians as human shields in violation of both international and Israeli law. That's the conclusion of a new investigation by the Associated Press based on interviews with Israeli soldiers and with Palestinians who said they were used as human shields to inspect buildings, tunnels, and other sites in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. The AP reports the Israeli soldiers said the practice was used in part to spare combat dogs from injury or death. One Israeli sergeant admitted to using Palestinians as young as 16 years old as human shields.
In February, the news outlet 972 revealed how Israel used an 80-year-old man as a human shield. Troops tied an explosive cord around his neck, then forced him to search abandoned buildings. After he finished the mission, he was ordered to flee, but then another Israeli unit fatally shot him and his wife. Haaretz and the Red Cross have also documented Israel's use of human shields. The AP report is based in part on testimonies collected by Breaking the Silence, a group made up of former Israeli soldiers opposed to the Israeli occupation. The groups also released photos of Palestinians being used as human shields in Gaza. We're joined now by the group's executive director, Nadav Weinman. He's a former Israeli soldier joining us from Tel Aviv. Thanks so much for being with us. Tell us what information you collected, the Israeli soldiers you talked to, and how exactly they're using Palestinians as human shields.
So, Amy, I've got to say that from the beginning of this war, we got testimonies from soldiers that told us they were ordered by senior officers to grab Palestinians next to them and to use them as human shields, meaning that they were ordered to send Palestinians. Some of them were dressed up with IDF uniform. Some of them had GoPro cameras on their head or on their chest. And then they were sent into tunnels and houses to check that there isn't any IEDs or explosive over there, so the soldier could enter safely or clear the area. And we got testimonies from different units, different times, and different places in the Gaza Strip, which shows, as you said, that it's widely spread, this protocol.
And Nadav, as far as you know, how long has this practice been in place?
Now, the first testimony that we have is from December 2023, meaning immediately after the ground invasion started. And the last testimony that we had is from the beginning of this year, beginning of 2025, just before the ceasefire. And it's something that the IDF is using more and more and more units and more areas throughout the war.
And to what extent are you aware of soldiers resisting these orders to use Palestinians as human shields?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Now, almost every soldier in the IDF learned about the fact that we used Palestinians as human shield during the Second Intifada. Back then, we called it the neighbor procedure. When you come to arrest a high-ranking Palestinian or you know that he's armed, so you grab the next-door neighbor and you told the neighbor, you knock on the door, not me, and maybe he will get shot. And if nobody shot him, then we told them, get inside the house, open all of the doors and open all of the lights, so we will be more safe. And that was banned by the Supreme Court in Israel in the end of the Second Intifada. So the reservist in the Israeli army grew up on that history, that we did something, it was bad, but it was banned, and that's it. And now they got a command that is exactly that, but I can say even worse, actually, right? Because he's dressing them up in IDF uniform. Some of the soldiers told us that it's maybe that they will be the target, so they will get shot. Now, the thing is that our testifier told us there was a debate inside their unit, but it's our testifiers. Right, I just read an op-ed in Haaretz of an officer that served in Gaza, and he said that almost every platoon is using human shields. Right, so Our testifiers told us there was a debate. They came to their senior officer and told them, hey, you know, that we were trying to fight, not to use human beings as human shields, or that dehumanization of Palestinians, or that's immoral or illegal, or I don't know what. But they cannot tell you what's going on in the greater IDF at the moment.
So explain, Nadav Weinman, why this is called the mosquito procedure. And also talk about what these Israeli soldiers told you about what happens to the Palestinians, many forced into houses, buildings, tunnels that are suspected of being booby-trapped, allegedly made to perform tasks like looking for explosives in tunnels.
Yeah, so first of all, a lot of things that the IDF has names for, I don't know the reason, but I can say that mosquito, it's like it's a bug that flies in the air and like you can kill it, who cares about it? And that was the relationship a lot of times between the soldiers and those Palestinian individuals that were used. And that's the word, they were used, right? We have a testifier that called them a sub-army of slaves. Now, the protocol is quite simple. You need that individual with you for a period of time, 2 days, 3 days, a week, 3 weeks. So it means that only when he's scanning a tunnel or a house or an alley, so he doesn't have handcuffs or a blindfold. The rest of the time, when he's with you inside the house, you need to feed him, you need to take him to the bathroom, but he's also handcuffed and blindfold, so you need to help him. In some unit, there were the mosquitoes inside the house were used to clean the house where the soldier stayed. So it's not only, you know, don't only think about that time in the tunnel when they need to endanger their life, think about the rest of the time, the majority of the day, that they were living with the soldiers inside the house. But again, eventually, they were supposed to be released. So it's, again, I'm quoting that soldier, a sub-army of slaves.
And Nadav, could you talk about the context in which this news has been coming out, where there's mounting anger against Netanyahu, protests all across the country yesterday for refusing to agree to a deal that would guarantee the release of Israeli hostages in Gaza? If you could explain what the mood is in Israel, the repeated calls for Netanyahu to step down. You've said that he's acting like a dictator.
Yeah, so from the very beginning of this war, we and other human rights organizations, we called for a deal to release our hostages, ceasefire, and enter humanitarian aid into Gaza. Now, at the beginning, we were a minority at the protest. But as this war, it's hard for me to call it a war because as a soldier, they told me that the war, it's two armies fighting one another. So is this intensive operation in Gaza went so long, and we killed so many civilians, and we lost so many of our soldiers, and also some of our hostages. More and more Israelis are resisting this war. And if you look at polls in Israel at the moment, you can see that the majority of Israelis, meaning even Bibi's voters, I believe, are against the continuous of this war and pro-hostage deal and pro-ending this war. And you can see the atmosphere on the streets. What happened yesterday, it was the 600th day of this operation or since October 7th. And we saw a lot of anger, you know, protesters in Tel Aviv took over the headquarters of the Likud party in Tel Aviv for a couple of hours, right? And they put signs, they said it's the embassy of Qatar because of the allegation that Qatar paid for the close in, advisors of Bibi to support them more than anything else. But I can say that what changed is in the mid-March, when we returned fighting in Gaza, when we continued bombing in Gaza, and we broke the ceasefire, and we stopped releasing our hostages, the majority of the audience in Israel understood that this is a war to protect Bibi's seat and Bibi's government, not to release our hostages, not to fight Hamas, and not to defend our borders. Because if that was the case, we will go to a hostage deal like Witkoff helped us achieve in the minute Trump stepped into office. Now, what we saw yesterday is more and more Israelis understanding that we are being lied to, that our soldiers are sent to die and to be killed for themselves without any good reason, without releasing our hostages or ending this war.
I wanted to turn for last example to the occupied West Bank. Israel admitting to strapping a wounded Palestinian man to the hood of an Israeli military vehicle during a raid on Jenin. Relatives and neighbors of the man, Mujahed Azmi, said Israeli soldiers used him as a human shield instead of allowing him to get medical care after he'd been shot. This is 13-year-old Al-Asmi speaking last year.
We told them we want an ambulance for the wounded person in the room, so the army told us to bring him to them. We got him outside, and for about an hour or half an hour, we kept asking for an ambulance. Then we called one. 15 minutes later, two jeeps came, and they got in here. The troops told us to turn around and not to look, and they put Mujahed on the jeep's hood and took him.
After a video of the incident went viral, the Israeli military released a statement claiming the action was, quote, in violation of orders and standard operating procedures. Nadav Ayman, if you can talk about how Israel is responding now to this latest news of this much more widespread use of exactly this kind of example.
Now, first of all, I've got to say that IDF spokesperson, a lot of times when they're confronted with something bad that soldier did that are against regulation, they said, it's against regulation, we will educate the soldiers, a mistake, and that's it. No investigation, no nothing. Now, I've got to say that now the IDF announced that six investigations were opened after the IDF soldier used Palestinians human shield in Gaza. And it's a joke. Right, because we have so many more incidents, and even Yaniv Kobovich from Haaretz newspapers published a couple of months ago that Herzi Halevi, then commander-in-chief of the IDF, was sitting in the meeting room while the Mosquito Protocol was discussed, meaning that everybody knew. Now, I've got to say that connects to something a lot bigger in the Israeli society, and that's dehumanization of Palestinians. Right? Since October 7th, it's even on steroids. Right? We have government members that openly talking about genocide. Right? When the head of the Labor Party, Yair Golan, last week said that the right-wing politician likes to kill Palestinian kids and babies, he was called as a traitor by our government. You know, we have ministers saying there isn't any innocent in Gaza, that all of the Palestinians are assisting terror or terrorists by themselves. And that seeps down into the IDF, into commands that soldiers are getting. And if you connect that with the fact that we have more and more soldier officers and commanders in the IDF that comes from the religious right wing or for the settler movement and believe that maybe it's a holy war, not a war of defending ourselves, you can understand why you have such a huge amount of those kind of incidents. Dehumanization of Palestinians in Israel became something so common that it also leads to these kind of practices inside the IDF.
Nadav Ayman, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of Breaking the Silence, a whistleblower group of former Israeli soldiers. When we come back, Israeli troops have fatally shot at least 10 Palestinians as they attempted to collect food and aid amidst the chaotic unveiling of a new Israeli-U.S.-backed aid distribution plan run by a shadowy U.S. group. We'll speak to Jeremy Scahill of Dropsite News in 20 seconds. Oh, 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 oh. Rosemond in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
An Israeli-U.S. plan to sideline the United Nations aid delivery system is continuing to cause chaos in Gaza. At least 10 Palestinians have been shot dead as Israeli troops have repeatedly opened fire at newly established aid distribution sites. The aid is being distributed by a shadowy U.S. group registered in Delaware called the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. A separate U.S. company called Safe Reach Solutions is helping to provide security. The New York Times reports that firm is run by a former senior CIA officer named Philip Riley, who reportedly helped train the Contras in Nicaragua in the 1980s. The UN and international aid groups have condemned the new Israeli-US plan. This is UNRWA Commissioner General Philippe Lazzarini.
The model of aid distribution proposed by Israel does not align with core humanitarian principle. It will deprive large part of Gaza, the highly vulnerable people, of desperately needed assistance.
We're joined now by Jeremy Scahill, co-founder of DropSite News, recently wrote an article headlined Netanyahu, Gaza Aid Scheme Offers Israel Symbolic Cover to Finish the Genocide. Jeremy Scahill has also been reporting on proposals for a new ceasefire in Gaza. We'll get to that in a minute, Jeremy. But why don't you lay out what is going on? This shadowy group that has moved in, condemned by humanitarian aid organizations, by the United Nations. Talk about who they are and what's happening.
I mean, first of all, Amy, we should be very clear that this cutout of a company, you know, cutout is a term of espionage. It was established by people with ties to the CIA and Israeli intelligence, was meant to serve as part of Netanyahu's war of annihilation. Netanyahu himself said the quiet part out loud in a recent speech when he said that he was getting some pressure even from his most passionate backers in the Republicans in the Senate. And he said, you know, that they didn't want the optics of starving Palestinians and that this could hinder the ability of the United States to continue arming and supporting Netanyahu. And so they wanted to give the veneer of some form of aid. And Netanyahu and Israel have been at war against UNRWA, the UN agency that was established in the aftermath of the Nakba in the late 1940s, when the state of Israel was imposed on Palestine as a European colonial settler state. And so this serves two purposes. It allowed Netanyahu to say, look, we're letting aid in and we're doing it so that Hamas can't steal it, which, by the way, was a lie. And even Biden's top humanitarian official, David Satterfield, said this week that there was no evidence ever presented by Israel that Hamas was stealing or hoarding the aid. So part of it was to give the veneer of we're doing something humanitarian. The other part of it was to continue the war against UNRWA, to destroy the premier aid organization serving Palestinian refugees, forcibly displaced people. And UNRWA, its very existence, Netanyahu and Israel hate because it recognizes the international laws that say that the Palestinians have a right to return to their land that they started to be to lose in 1947, 1948, when the Nakba began. So they created this shell company with ties to American intelligence officers as a way of further destroying UNRWA, but also serving Netanyahu's agenda. They then bring in an American mercenary company that, you know, Blackwater style guys that you saw in Iraq and Afghanistan throughout the so-called war on terror. And then they created what international aid officials have said are concentration camp or internment camp like conditions. Others have likened it to ghetto style conditions where Palestinians are going to be forced to stand out in the heat all day in barbed wire fence enclosures looking like a cage. And then they get a box with a paltry amount of food aid in it. There's no medicine. There's no infant formula. This is all just trickery that is being used to further the genocide. And Amy, I've been talking to people. A personal friend of mine whose family is from Khan Yunis, four members of his family were shot sniper style yesterday by the Israeli military when they went to pick up these aid boxes at one of the two sites, the one near Rafah. What is happening is that the Israelis are also using this as an intelligence operation. They've snatched, kidnapped a number of Palestinians. They've interrogated them when they don't get the answers they want. They've disappeared them. They haven't given any mechanism for how people are supposed to line up or know where to go. What we're hearing from sources on the ground is that word just spreads via WhatsApp and text messages. Oh, there's going to be aid delivered in this place. People go there and it's just pure chaos. So none of this is by accident. This is by design. And you have, on the one hand, a pittance of aid that is being actually distributed relative to what is needed just to address the basic starvation factor in Gaza right now. And on the other hand, Israel is using this and the desperation of people to further dehumanize Palestinians. And when they go to try to desperately grab whatever aid they can, as we saw happen at a UN warehouse, then they say, well, Hamas is shooting starving people trying to get food. No, Israel has intentionally starved the population of Gaza now for 3 months. They have continued the campaign of dehumanization, and they're using food as a weapon of war in an effort to further dehumanize Palestinians. And the last thing I'll say about this is Netanyahu and Bezalel Smotrich, who's in the war cabinet, both said that the point of this is to lure Palestinians as though they're animals going into a cage, lure them with the bait of promise of aid, and then entrap them in the south of Gaza, where they can either kill them in an increasingly shrinking killing cage or lock that cage and ship them off to another country. They call it Trump's plan, but actually it's been Netanyahu's life's work to try to erase Palestinians as a people and as a territory.
Well, on Wednesday, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation posted a video online showing Palestinians lined up cheering at a new aid distribution site. The post includes this message: humanity shines as thousands cheer the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, heralding a new era of hope and compassion.
I mean, this...
who's totally masked, making a heart sign. The Pulitzer Prize-winning Palestinian poet Mossab Abu Toha responded to the video by writing, quote, "Concentration camp, humiliating people starved for 86 days. Shame on this world." Jeremy, your response.
I mean, there are no words to offer in response, because we know that the entire point of this was to serve the Israeli genocide against the Palestinian people. We know that the agenda at play here was to try to lure them with food as a bait to try to wipe them out. This is part of the life's work, the central life's work of Benjamin Netanyahu. And in fact, a recent public opinion poll in Israel said that 82% of Jewish Israelis want Palestinians removed from Gaza. The world understands what the agenda is. Many governments that are now starting to speak up were enablers of this. Many news organizations are starting to speak up that were enablers of this. History should never forget what the United States facilitated under both Joe Biden and Donald Trump.
Very quickly, Jeremy, the issue of the ceasefire proposals, you've spoken with Hamas officials. Explain what's happening right now.
Yeah, well, Amy, I actually just saw the latest draft that was circulated by Steve Witkoff. This was announced yesterday with Donald Trump. And basically what's happening here is Hamas had agreed to a version of this framework that they were told by a U.S. emissary would satisfy Donald Trump. The Israelis went nuts over that. And so what's happening right now is there's an attempt to amend language. It boils down to this, Amy. Israel wants to be able to continue the genocide if it determines it wants to do so. Hamas has said it's a red line if the deal does not include a clear path to negotiations for a permanent end to the war. So what is happening right now is that there are reviews happening on Hamas's side, on Israel's side, and we're going to have to see. Donald Trump is the defining factor. Everyone involved knows that the only person capable of ending this genocidal war is Donald Trump. It's a sick reality. It has to do with his business interests in the Gulf and elsewhere and his image of himself. But it all boils down to that. It has nothing to do with a humanitarian objective or saving Palestinian lives. It has everything to do with whether Donald Trump decides Netanyahu's war is bad for his business politically and his personal family business.
We just have 30 seconds, but you've reported someone who served as a backdoor negotiator for the Trump administration is Dr. Bashar Ababa. Can you explain who he is?
Bashar Ababa was the head of Arab Americans for Trump. You know, Donald Trump tried to hit Kamala Harris because he knew that she was very unpopular because of her Gaza stance. He's been the U.S. emissary that's been dealing directly with Hamas. I'm told that often what happens is Ababa is in the room with Hamas officials. They then get Witkoff on the line or they communicate by text messages. You know, this is a lower level official, but it seems clear that that backdoor communication is what led to Witkoff announcing that there may be a breakthrough imminently.
Jeremy Scahill, we want to thank you so much for being with us, co-founder of DropSite News. We'll link to your recent reports. That does it for our show. We're hiring a senior headline news producer, a director of audience, and a director of technology. You can find out more about these full-time jobs at democracynow.org/jobs. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!